This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Even though you're patrolling through the jungle there, I mean, you can also smell where the locals are being, because you can smell Indonesian cigarettes, and you know that someone's been there. A lot of people trivialise East Timor because they're forgotten, and they think that peacekeeping is something different than war, when in fact, I've got to say, even the peacekeeping missions to Somalia and places like that are terrifying things.
Pop. Other side of the fucking... Right, guys.
Also, the feeling that, you know, when you're walking around, that someone could be pointing a rifle at you or some sort of weapon at you, and you just can't see them. That's sort of on your mind a lot. Well, it's on my mind a lot anyway. You know, that's what worried me.
Stop. Put the weapon down. Nasi Senjata Tubawa!
Watch that flake. Get a bead on him. Do not fire on him unless he points at you.
Stress is still there. They are affected by the same stresses. It may be that firing shots, that is, in a warlike situation, might in fact release some of these stresses. It might be worse waiting for the bang than it is with the bang.
Hi there. Welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. I'm Tom Morton. And today, waiting for the bang, the perils of peacekeeping. Australian forces have now been involved in more peacekeeping operations than wars. East Timor was the largest and most successful of these. But as we'll hear today, there's a large and growing body of evidence that peacekeeping can take a toll on the peacekeepers themselves. Some East Timor veterans have committed suicide. Some have been diagnosed with major depression, drug and alcohol dependence, or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And some have committed crimes. We'll also hear that some East Timor vets believe they're getting a raw deal from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Here's Moose Dunlop. He's a former Vietnam veteran and now president of the Royal Australian Regiment Association in South Australia.
They came to our attention initially because they were very, very angry men. They were angry because they considered their entitlements and rights and their position was not being heard. That made them even more angry and in some cases exacerbated their conditions.
Moose Dunlop says that government needs to recognise that keeping the peace can be a dangerous and a stressful business.
If you are patrolling, for example, Dili at night, there are still concerns about someone shooting you, and they would be aware that there was a federal policeman killed up there at some stage. They'd be aware that there are weapons in the community. They know there are riots. They know it's a very unhealthy place to be. And, of course, the other thing is over a long period, even if there are no individual stressors, as a psychiatrist call it, an individual may well suffer PTSD just simply through exposure to whatever stress it is that he cannot cope with over a long period.
There was always a sort of thought in the back of your mind, are the people I'm talking to militia, or are they genuine sort of East Timorese that are happy to see us? And so, yeah, there was always a bit of tension, and, of course, everybody in East Timor carries a machete.
The Australian forces in East Timor were right at the pointy end of peacekeeping, and the long-term consequences of living with that kind of tension may not show up for months or years afterwards. David Buck was a former lieutenant commander with the Royal Australian Navy. He'd served in East Timor and been personally commended by Major General Peter Cosgrove. In August 2005, Buck walked into the Yamina Beach Bowling Club on the New South Wales Central Coast wearing a backpack with wires hanging out of it. He handed a note to the manager of the club. The note claimed that he had 11 kilograms of explosives in the backpack, which would be remotely detonated unless the manager handed over all the paper money in the till. Here's how David Buck himself describes the events of that day.
I made a very foolish mistake in August last year. I think it was when I was at the depths of depression. My wife had stopped work to look after me, to keep me out of trouble. And this particular day she was going into the city and she knew I'd had a really, really bad night with nightmares. And she offered to stay home, and I said, no, I'll be okay, I'm fine, I'll just sit down and play on the computer. And basically, once she'd gone, I'd cancelled all my appointments and decided that I was going to try and commit suicide by pretending I had a backpack with a bomb in it and go down and rob a club and hope the police come along and shot me. It didn't turn out that way. I ended up sitting down in the gutter, having a smoke, waiting for the police to come and arrest me. I guess it took 11 months of going backwards and forwards to the local court and then finally going to the district court and pleading guilty to demanding property with menaces. And I was very fortunate in that I got a magistrate, or sorry, a judge, who was able to see past the offence itself and see the cry for help, I guess.
In his judgment, Judge Michael Finnane said that David Buck was, quote, someone who could properly be regarded as a hero, unquote. And he put Buck on a 5-year good behaviour bond. Here's a reading from Judge Finnane's remarks on sentence.
The offender is a victim of war and someone who at the time of this particular incident was getting active psychological counselling to debrief him about a series of traumatic events that had occurred when he served in the Navy. He is a tragic and broken man who has been exposed in the course of his service in the Navy to terrible events, which it is hard for me to fully comprehend. He is a casualty of war and deserves to be treated with compassion rather than punishment.
On the day that David Buck walked into the Yamina Bowling Club, he was depressed and confused. He'd been medically discharged from the Navy against his will, and he was drinking and gambling heavily. Buck concocted a bizarre story which involved him pretending that he'd been wired up with explosives by Arab terrorists. There were no explosives in David Buck's backpack. By a remarkable stroke of luck, the maintenance manager of the bowling club was in the Army Reserve. He reckoned that the wires coming out of the backpack didn't look like a bomb, and he managed to talk Buck down. But it could all have gone horribly wrong, and Buck could easily have received a much tougher sentence from Judge Finnane. However, the judge took into account a psychiatrist's report, which said that Buck was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of his service in East Timor.
I didn't want to admit that I had PTSD, but that's what it was, because I never thought I'd be the sort of bloke that would suffer from that. I'd done, you know, like at that stage, I think I'd done 34 or 35 years in the Navy. I'd seen everything, done everything, run pretty hard, and never really worry about too much. So I didn't expect to be struck by PTSD.
It's now well documented that soldiers can suffer a range of mental health problems as a result of combat. But should it surprise us when peacekeepers suffer the same problems? Professor Mark Creamer.
No, I don't think it should, really. We now have good research from many peacekeeping deployments from around the world, including places, of course, like Rwanda and Somalia and Bosnia and so on, that suggest quite significant rates of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, and indeed other mental health problems following these kinds of deployments. Maybe rates around anything between 8 and 12%. But it does depend a lot, of course, on the nature of the deployment.
Mark Creamer, he's director of the Australian Centre for Post-Traumatic Mental Health and an expert on PTSD in the military. He says that peacekeeping involves a range of experiences which may trigger PTSD.
So there may be significant fear for their own safety or threat to their own safety. They may be under fire from militia, for example, which happened in the early parts of the East Timor deployment. But I think really peacekeeping generally demands a whole different and complex set of skills, often I think for which people are not necessarily terribly well trained.
That we've seen at the moment have just basically been hand homemade sort of weapons, like very crude rifles and that sort of thing, or shotguns.
The East Timor peacekeeping operation was in many ways the most challenging that our defence forces have ever faced. From the beginning, they encountered situations where the lines between peacekeeping and combat could easily become blurred.
With a heavy belt of live rounds threaded through a 50-caliber machine gun mounted on a top turret, an Australian Army armoured personnel carrier makes its way out of Dili's airport.
Dili has essentially deserted. You have truckloads of Indonesian military and militias rampaging through the city. A great deal of the public infrastructure in Dili is either destroyed or is burning. There is rubbish all over the streets. There is human excrement all over the streets. And then once the Australians begin to patrol out into Dili and its environs, then the true horror of what has happened becomes readily apparent.
Dr. Garth Pratton, he's a historian at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra.
And it's then that they start to find bodies in drains, bodies in wells, bodies in gutters, the remnants of massacres within buildings in terms of bloodstains, blood trails, and those signs of what happens are then continually confronting the Australian forces as they then push out from Dili in the ensuing weeks. Although the militias then gradually are pushed back towards Indonesian West Timor as Interfet extends its influence, that there are still reports coming in of these pro-Indonesian militias going about their work of extortion, of an intimidation, as they withdraw back towards West Timor.
There was always a sort of thought in the back of your mind, are the people I'm talking to militia, or are they genuine sort of East Timorese that are happy to see us? And so, yeah, there was always a bit of tension, and, of course, everybody in East Timor carries a machete.
David Buck had no idea that he'd be going to East Timor. He was a 44-year-old naval officer specialising in electronics, and he also spoke fluent Thai. Because of his language skills, Buck was asked to act as a liaison officer with the Thai battalion who were part of the peacekeeping force. He arrived in East Timor in November 1999. Within a day or so, he found himself in Vakeke, a seaside town close to Bakau on Timor's northeast coast. David Buck quickly learned that keeping the peace can be a dangerous business.
The only bridge that led from Bakau into Vakeke was starting to disintegrate. So I arranged for the 21 Construction Squadron people from the army to come down and survey the bridge. They did that 2 days later, came down, surveyed it and told me that the bridge was unfit for vehicular traffic. It was okay for people to walk over, but no vehicles. So basically what we did was we chopped two trees down, one either side of the bridge, and we posted some UN police officers either side of the bridge to tell people that, look, you can't drive your cars over. If you want to bring produce in, you can take it off your truck one side, carry it over, put it on a truck the other side and drive it into Vakeke, but no cars over.
3 days later, David Buck got an urgent call for help from the bridge.
Myself and the army, the Thai Army Major, went out in a four-wheel drive. We arrived out there to find quite a large group of East Timorese armed with machetes, a car on the Bakau side of the bridge, and the UN police officers trying to, you know, stop people driving the car over. And when we got there, I approached the driver of the car and said, look, you know, you can't drive the car over the bridge because it's dangerous. And the gentleman in the car alleged that he was the Bishop of Bakau and he was entitled to use the bridge, and he was going to use the bridge to visit his parishioners in Vakeke. And basically, we were at a Mexican standoff, and I said, look, you can't use the bridge. He insisted that he was going to use the bridge, and if we didn't let him use the bridge, then his people would, you know, make sure that he used the bridge by getting rid of us. At this stage, both myself and the Thai Major had our sidearms out and actioned. At that stage, it really did start getting very ugly, and it was only by dint of the fact that a Unimog full of Thai soldiers turned up.
Sorry, a Unimog?
A truck, yeah, it's an army truck with about 16 Thai soldiers with their M16s in it. They turned up and leapt out, and basically that was the end of that standoff. The Timorese sort of melted away, and the bishop got back into his car and drove back up towards Bakau. It was only then that the Major and I sort of realised we both still had our weapons in our hands and they were both still in action. So, you know, we had a bit of a yak about it later and said, look, you know, that's probably as close as we ever want to be to shooting somebody. And it really did get quite nasty, very threatening, and not something that I'd been trained for.
The Mexican standoff at the bridge is an example of just how complex and unpredictable the job of the peacekeeper can be. Peacekeepers themselves can easily become a focus for the frustrations of the people they're there to protect.
If I could, I'll just describe to you one, probably the most traumatic incident that I had while I was there. This was also in Vakeke. I got a radio message from InterFed headquarters. They wanted me to act as a beachmaster for the return of 135 IDPs from West Timor.
It's an internally displaced persons.
Sorry, yeah, internally displaced persons. These are people that have been forcibly taken by the Indonesians when they left and taken over to West Timor. These people are now being repatriated to their home province, which was Vakeke. I knew that the people in Biaso were not going to be real happy about 135 possible militia, which is that's how they looked at all IDPs. The people that didn't leave the country looked at anybody who was coming back as a militia.
David Butt wanted to get the returning refugees off the beach and away from potential trouble as quickly as possible. But despite his careful planning, things came unstuck. The boats carrying them arrived 5 hours late, and trucks promised to carry them to their homes failed to show up.
By the time the LCH beached and the people started coming off, there were probably 1,500 very angry East Timorese yelling abuse at these poor people getting off the boat. And most of the people getting off were women and children carrying all their belongings, you know, like furniture on their head and that sort of thing. And it was a very, very touching to see these people come off and copying the abuse they were copying.
Buck and the Thai soldiers got the refugees safely off the beach and into a warehouse. But the crowd outside were getting angrier and angrier.
You know, the volume sort of got louder and louder and louder. They started throwing rocks at the roof of the rice warehouse. And so we thought, well, you know, we've got to get these people out of here. By this stage, of course, it's dark. And I walked along the road in front of the lead Humvee, sort of yelling out, I can't even remember what I said now, but it was in Timorese. I was telling them to go home. And I've forgotten what the words were, but it was just go home. And walked along the road for about 100 yards with a convoy following, you know, behind me, and then sort of stepped off the road and they zoomed off, and then I walked back. And I can tell you it's the hardest 100 yards I've ever walked, because the whole time I was worried that, you know, somebody with a homemade gun out of the darkness could, you know, pick me off or whatever.
Were you armed?
Yeah, but only with a 9mm pistol.
So in other words, it was dark, you were in the front of this convoy, and basically you were potentially a sitting target, yeah?
Yes.
Or a walking one, I should say.
Yeah, but, I mean, there were lots of other targets too. But it was just hard. Once the convoy had driven off, I then had to turn around and walk back that 100 yards in the darkness on my own. And that was when I was really worried.
But you weren't aware until sometime afterwards that that incident had, in fact, had a longer-term effect on you?
No. In fact, before I left East Timor, I think I left there on around about the 6th of February, I went back into Dili and I was given a psychological debriefing. And one of the questions they asked me was, you know, do you feel that you've witnessed anything while you've been here that's going to upset you? And I said, no. As far as I'm concerned, yes, I've seen some horrible things, but I don't think it's going to affect me in any way. And it certainly didn't for a couple of years.
David Butt told the psychiatrist who diagnosed his post-traumatic stress disorder that he'd been exposed to 15 separate traumatic incidents. Some of those he still can't talk about. After his diagnosis, he was medically discharged from the Navy after 36 years' service. Buck is now on a TPI, or totally and permanently incapacitated pension, but he'd rather have stayed in the Navy.
And I don't bear any grudges to the Navy or the Defence Force or anybody else. I'm happy to be alive. Could things have been done differently? I think they could have given me a little bit more support when I got crook. They could have given me a bit more time to get better. You know, for 36 years I went wherever they asked me to go, did whatever they asked me to do. And when I was in trouble, they ditched me.
David Buck says that he's started to turn his life around since the day he walked into the Amina Beach Bowling Club, pretending he had explosives in his backpack. He's training to be a pensions officer, assisting other veterans. He doesn't visit pubs or clubs, and he says he's received a huge amount of support from his wife and family. But Buck is in no doubt that on that day at the bowling club, he was trying to get himself killed by the police. Fortunately, he didn't succeed. But suicide is now recognised as a significant problem amongst former peacekeepers.
Basically, all we done was just patrol around the countryside, up and down the mountains, checking on all the hidden villages, make sure everybody's okay, and et cetera, go along the border and that. But even though you're patrolling through the jungle there, I mean, you can also smell where the locals have been, because you can smell Indonesian cigarettes, and you know that someone's been there. Also, the feeling that, you know, when you're walking around, that someone could be pointing a rifle at you, or some sort of weapon at you, and you just can't see them. That's sort of on your mind a lot. Well, it's on my mind a lot anyway. You know, that's what worried me.
Shane was a rifle platoon sergeant in the 1st Royal Australian Regiment. They were deployed along the border with West Timor, one of the most difficult and dangerous postings in the entire peacekeeping operation.
You know, we didn't really know if one of the supposed locals are walking around pacing the compounds they're in and just checking out to see if, you know, how big they are, see if they can throw grenades in. I mean, when 6RO went over there, 6th Royal Australian Regiment, within a fed, I mean, they had a few trouble with some militia and that sort of thing, throwing grenades in their compounds and that. So, well, I know I was pretty tense about that sort of thing. A lot of the people that never went field or anything like that really didn't understand it, but basically all the fellas that did really thought about that sort of thing all the time.
Peacekeepers like Shane face two potential challenges: incursions by militias and Indonesian armed forces eyeballing them from across the border. But the rules of engagement meant that they could defend themselves and civilians if they were threatened. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Elliott.
Oh, it could go through from anything such as hand signals and verbal warnings, or even before that, maybe signage around a specific compound, through to actually shouting warnings and offering to stop vehicles at roadblocks, through to actually, if they felt the need to show an aggressive force, to actually aim weapons at people and return fire if they were fired upon. So there's a whole series of from the first raising of a hand through to actual combat engagement, a whole series of responses through that.
Several times, full-scale fighting nearly broke out between Australian forces and the Indonesian military. This report from the ABC's Raphael Epstein shows just how tense things could get.
Stop. Put the weapon down. Nasi Senjata to Bawa!
Watch that fake. Get a bead on him. Do not fire on him unless he points at you. This fuckwit in front of the tree.
When the standoff has cooled down, an Indonesian officer and his Australian counterpart compare maps.
This river here is a river you can see behind me. Our troops are on this side, just here.
The TNI use an old Dutch map showing Motain west of the border. Interfet says its map, printed in Indonesia, shows Motain in the east. Interfet later maintains militiamen fired the first shots, even though the army translator at the incident, Major David Kilcullen, says the Indonesian officer at the scene said there was no militia in the area.
He stated that we were still 100 metres.
One day we were just patrolling along the road. We decided to go down to the border and walk along the beach there, and I noticed that there was a TNI soldier standing up, but another one was down in front of him, and he was pointing the rifle directly at me.
Yeah, just so that we're clear, TNI is Indonesian Armed Forces, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. Now, I really didn't know what to do. I had to stand there and, you know, with my hand on my hip sort of thing, because if I'd have raised the rifle or done anything about it, because of the rules of engagement, well, and or it's a TNI person because of all the political situation, then I might have got the blame for it. I might have been the one burnt. So I just stood there, and then when we patrolled away, we patrolled away. And I still think about it every day, plus a few other little things that happened. I still think about those.
Like a number of the East Timor veterans who we've spoken to for this program, Shane didn't feel at the time that he'd been traumatised by his experiences. It wasn't until he got back to Australia that he began to have problems. He freaked out a number of times after drinking heavily. He had trouble being in crowds, his marriage broke up, and he became increasingly isolated.
Yeah, like I said, if it wasn't for the few friends that I got, plus my parents aren't far from me, then I would have gone bush ages ago because, you know, really, a lot of people just don't understand what you've seen. It might sound, you know, weak to them. And consequently, they've sort of made me feel weak and, you know, useless. So basically, like I said, I mainly just hide and all that sort of stuff. I would have gone bush just so I could be by myself and not have anyone criticise me.
Shane has now been diagnosed by a psychiatrist as having post-traumatic stress disorder. He's been medically discharged from the army, even though he didn't really want to leave. And 2 years ago, he lodged a claim for compensation with the Department of Veterans Affairs. He's still waiting for that claim to be processed. As we heard earlier, a number of East Timor veterans are angry and frustrated by the way that the department is dealing with their claims. And they're being supported by veterans of earlier conflicts. Moose Dunlop is president of the Royal Australian Regiment Association in South Australia.
Tom, our concerns, I suppose, primarily would relate to their being treated in accordance with their contract when they joined up. Now, all soldiers and their families, we reckon, are bound by a contract when they enlist in the army, that if something happens to them on an overseas deployment, they'll be looked after. We want their conditions to be quite clear. We don't want to see them eroded. We want their entitlements to be the same as ours were under the Veterans Entitlement Act.
So what sort of a pattern are you seeing with the people who've been to East Timor and have now come back? What kinds of difficulties are they experiencing?
One of the problems that we see is when claims for injuries are submitted through the Veterans Department, the onus of proof appears to be on the individual to prove the date and the time and precisely what occurred to give him the stressors, for example, to provide him with mental problems or even physical injuries. You probably know about the well-documented case of the fellow who was in the NEAS helicopter accident who had to prove that he was there. So it's a philosophy that appears to be creeping into the department whereby an individual, as legitimate as his claim may be, has to prove that he was actually there and that injury was a result of what happened to him.
What's the problem with that?
The problem is in all cases the individual doesn't remember exactly what happened to him, especially if his injuries are physical and in some cases they are cumulative. And as you'd appreciate, it's very difficult for some individuals to remember exactly what happened where and when.
Under the Veterans Entitlements Act, the Department of Veterans Affairs must be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that a veteran's incapacity is not related to their war service. So, in other words, the Act places the onus of proof on the department. But Moose Dunlop says there's been a subtle shift in the culture of the Department of Veterans Affairs in recent years. He believes that the department is taking an increasingly adversarial approach to claims, effectively shifting the onus of proof back onto the veterans. But that's a claim which the Minister of Veterans Affairs, Bruce Bilson, rejects.
No, I wouldn't accept that. I mean, that's simply factually not the case. Procedurally, completely inconsistent with the way the system's set up. And also denies the simple reality that claims are being accepted. There's a positive onus on my department to accumulate whatever material is available to seek to substantiate a claim and see where that causal link exists. That's the way the system's designed. What is clear, though, is every opportunity is made available to consider whatever material may be available, particularly the ones, the information the department, my department, proactively seeks from military records, from reports of events, from ex-service organisations, from advocates for veterans who have processed similar claims. It's a very pro-veteran system.
Mr. Bilson's office supplied us with figures stating that 2,782 East Timor veterans have made compensation claims. 316 of those have been rejected. And you can find a full list of departmental figures on the Background Briefing website. As we've heard, though, there are concerns amongst veterans about some of the ways that the department is gathering information about claims. Many of those concerns centre on Right Way Research, a private company which the department employs to do historical research on the claims. Those concerns have prompted the Shadow Minister for Veterans Affairs, Alan Griffin, to take a closer look at Right Ways.
Well, it was quite a bit of speculation within the veterans community that was coming out through emails, but also through correspondence and with just speaking to people at meetings. The anecdotal examples that were being put to us about what was happening with investigations suggested that it was pretty shoddy and that some of the work that was being done really wasn't of a standard that ought to be used to determine the entitlements of veterans.
Officials from the Department of Veterans Affairs have been quizzed about Right Ways in Senate estimates. But Alan Griffin says that there are still important questions which remain unanswered.
We want details on how many cases have been referred to Right Ways, what have been the results from those investigations, when has there been a situation where those investigations have been questioned, and to try and build a picture, if you like, about what's actually been undertaken.
I mean, is there anything wrong, in your view, with the Department of Veterans Affairs outsourcing some of the investigation of claims to a private company?
In principle, no, but the question's always going to be how is it undertaken and what are the implications for those involved? And when we look at the circumstances of a lot of veterans who will often have psychological issues to deal with, will often be feeling quite frail on a physical level as well as potentially a mental level, we've got to be careful. And I think these people have genuinely earned the right to have the benefit of the doubt.
A number of the questions that Alan Griffin is raising here are crystallised in the case of Paul Dignan. Dignan is an infantry sergeant who was posted to Dili in the early months of 2000. He assisted with the handover from Australia to the UN and then worked as receptionist for the theatre of war. The outlines of Paul Dignan's story are not unlike those we've already heard in the program. After he returned to Australia, all seemed well to begin with. But then he became increasingly irritable and angry with his family and subordinates. He drank heavily, and eventually a friend who was a Vietnam veteran suggested he might need help.
He said, how's your family life? And I said, it's stuffed. I'm leaving the bitch on Tuesday. I've had enough of her. And he said, you ever thought it might be you? And I went, huh? And basically it was me. It was a post-traumatic stress disorder. It was not my wife. It was not, you know, some of the corporals that I've abused at work. It was me.
Paul Dignan went to a psychiatrist who diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder. The psychiatrist's report states that
Mr. Dignan's post-traumatic stress disorder is clearly and directly related to the traumatic experiences he was exposed to during his trip to East Timor.
However, when Dignan applied to the Department of Veterans Affairs for compensation, his claim was rejected. Paul Dignan now became embroiled in a long and arduous low-intensity conflict with the Department of Veterans Affairs. The conflict was all about the traumatic incidents which Dignan had experienced in East Timor. The first of these involved a riot he'd been caught in while driving through Dili. Large numbers of young men had come into the city from the countryside seeking work with the United Nations and had become frustrated and angry when the jobs didn't eventuate. Here's how Paul Dignan described the riot to Background Briefing.
From footpath to footpath, it was just a sea, a complete sea of people rioting with weapons, with bricks, with machetes, with swords, whatever.
So you've described it, there was a sea of people in the street, and you actually then became caught in this riot, is that correct?
Yeah, I was at an intersection, and there was a Portuguese company of riot soldiers at one end of the street, and which had just dispersed the riot, basically, and people disappeared into houses and into the Dili Cathedral. As I rocked up, though, the Portuguese company decided to leave because they thought it was more secure. As soon as they left, or as they were even getting on the trucks, people poured out of the houses and the cathedral, grabbed shovels and picks from a work site, and as I said, they were armed with machetes, swords, bricks, rocks, and just swarmed around us. Yeah, it was a complete sea of people that you could not see through.
And they were angry?
Oh, very much so. I mean, they'd basically been conned to come into town, and there were no jobs for them. They were very angry, hated the UN, and they were really, really, trying to get at us, thinking we were United Nations.
Were any of you armed?
Yes, we had three automatic rifles in the vehicle with us.
there was a chief chasing us at the back of the vehicle. I mean, chasing's probably the wrong word because we weren't really moving very fast. He had a sword with him and was egging people on to attack us. One of the fellas in the back wanted to shoot this chief because standard procedures is to shoot the leader and the crowd disperses. But I felt we may have been able to get out of it without injuring anybody, especially since I had empathy for these people and why they were rioting. I didn't see the point in shooting someone with a sword because he was angry with the United Nations.
Paul Dignan's psychiatrist's report clearly states that the riot was one of the contributing factors in his post-traumatic stress disorder. But the department wasn't convinced. They referred his case to Right Way Research Service for further investigation. Right Way came back saying that they could find no record of the riot described by Paul Dignan.
The researcher was unable to locate any specific reference to any similar incident occurring in Dili during the period the veteran was deployed to East Timor.
In other words, Right Ways are casting doubt on whether or not the riot described by Paul Dignan actually occurred. Dignan wasn't happy with the report or with the DVA's treatment of his claim. He appealed to the Veterans Review Board to have it reconsidered. Dignan provided the board with a witness statement from a civilian who'd been in the vehicle with him during the riot, and the statement supported his account of what had happened. The Department of Veterans Affairs asked Right Ways to go away and look for any new information that they could find about the riot. And Right Ways came back with a supplementary report, and this is what it said.
There was one incident involving a riot during the veteran's deployment. In this incident, Timorese civilians waiting to apply for UN employment became enraged when interviews were stopped. The description of this incident does not, however, match the details provided by the veteran.
Right Ways don't cite any source for this information, nor do they say why they believe this incident doesn't match the details provided by Paul Dignan. However, Background Briefing has been able to find a number of media reports of a riot which match both the dates and details given by Dignan, including a TV report by the ABC's Mark Bowling.
They came looking for work. Some of the thousands of East Timor's unemployed, angry as they wait outside the United Nations administrative headquarters.
This is our country, you know!
But there were no jobs here. UN riot police on standby in case of violence.
UNTIAD and the government administration, the civil service that we're going to set up, will not be able to absorb all these people.
Only a lucky few find jobs as rebuilding East Timor moves slowly. But the capital, Dili, has become a magnet, especially for young men seeking work.
Yes, we are angry because we need to live like other people. So if there is no job for us, how can we live here?
Against this backdrop of unemployment, street violence and crime is already on the rise.
Right Way Research told Background Briefing that they were unable to comment on any individual cases and referred us to the Department of Veterans Affairs. But the question still needs to be asked, did they look hard enough for evidence of the riot? I put the following question to the Minister for Veterans Affairs, Bruce Bilson.
Wouldn't you say, though, that it is incumbent on a researcher to try and determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to support a claim? And in the circumstance where a psychiatrist's report has clearly identified a couple of incidents as being the basis for a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, that it's incumbent on that researcher to look for all the evidence that they can as to whether or not the particular incident cited as a cause of the diagnosis actually occurred.
Yes, and that's exactly what happens. I mean, again, let me explain the process, which is a process that sees almost 60,000 claims determined each year. This is not an unusual process. This is a well-understood, well-supported, pro-veteran process. In the case of Right Way's role, their role is to look at the available information. Their role is to establish what historical records, facts, material is available that would help the decision-maker arrive at an informed, a fair and a consistent decision in relation to particular claims. What the issue is whether the particular circumstances to which Mr. Dignon points to that has such a traumatic and stressful impact on his emotional well-being give rise to the condition that doctors diagnosed him as having.
The Veterans Review Board acknowledged that the riot did occur and that Paul Dignon was caught in it. However, the board took the view that the experience of the riot wasn't enough to have caused his PTSD.
The board finds that the incident could not reasonably have been perceived by him as involving a threat of serious injury or death.
This is in direct conflict with the original psychiatrist's report.
Mr. Dignon told me he felt intensely frightened. He became so distressed that he lost count of time. Mr. Dignon thought he was going to be killed.
Experts in the field agree that a belief that you're going to be killed is one of the preconditions for developing PTSD. But the Veterans Review Board rejected Paul Dignan's claim for compensation in relation to the riot. Well, the board also had to consider a further claim by Dignan, and this was related to another incident which occurred while he was in East Timor.
Well, this is much harder for me to go through in my own mind. There was an incident where it was suspected that militiamen had decapitated several children around Dili, and I actually came across that site perhaps later on in the day where the bodies were still there.
And how did you come across that site?
It was a normal a patrol, if you like, that we would do just to show a presence in Dili, and we moved upon a dirt road and came across a group of CIVPOL, which were the United Nations Civilian Police, who were surrounding a body. I didn't know at the time, so I just put my troops out where I thought they should be to provide area protection. The civilian police told us to move on immediately as I approached the area. We then continued our patrol on down the road and came across another one. And yeah, it was a big day.
So you saw the bodies of the children?
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Tom, you know, I don't know. I don't really cope very well with that.
Once again, the psychiatrist's report clearly links this incident with the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. But the Veterans Review Board found that Paul Dignan had failed to provide evidence that it occurred.
The board finds it incredible that such an incident would not have caused widespread concern and become widely known.
And that's a view echoed by the Minister for Veterans Affairs, Bruce Bilson.
There hasn't been any material available to substantiate atrocities of the kind he describes, which I'm sure the international community, those who served with him, those monitoring and observing activities in East Timor, would have been all over. The whole world would have known about those things.
Once again, both the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Veterans Review Board relied on a report from Right Way Research. Right Way said they could find no evidence of any decapitated children being found in or around Dili. Moreover, the Right Way report stated that
by the time Mr. Dignon arrived in East Timor, all of the bodies from the post-election violence had been recovered and buried.
The Right Way report said that Paul Dignon had arrived in East Timor on the 23rd of February 2000. But in fact, Dignon had arrived a month earlier in mid-January. Through January and well into February, the United Nations was still exhuming bodies from a number of sites in East Timor. Sydney Jones, at the time head of the UN Human Rights Division in East Timor, told the Sydney Morning Herald on January the 29th, 2000,
"One thing is certain, and that is that the number of reports of people being killed and the number of reported grave sites is steadily increasing."
Background Briefing could find no media reports from the time which referred directly to decapitated children. But we contacted Sydney Jones, now with the ICG in Jakarta, and asked her whether the incident that Paul Dignan describes could have occurred. Sydney Jones emailed this reply.
"I don't remember any cases of decapitated children having been found in early 2000, and since I was in charge of the morgue at the time, I can say with some certainty that no such cases were brought to us there. But it doesn't mean that it didn't happen, it's just that I didn't come across it."
The Veterans Review Board said that it had great difficulty accepting Paul Dignan's account of the incident involving the decapitated children. The board described his account as confused.
But it's widely recognised that people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder can have trouble remembering details of the events that traumatised them. Professor Mark Creamer.
Well, PTSD has a funny effect on memory, really, because it does two things. On the one hand, it heightens recall of certain aspects of the event. And usually these are the most frightening, the most grotesque sights, the most dangerous kinds of aspects of the incident. And of course, it's these that form the content of the memories that come back, the dreams, the nightmares, or the intrusive images that people complain of. So we've got heightened recall of the worst aspects, but we have reduced recall of the details. We have poor memory for all the peripheral details around what happened. And I think that that creates problems when they're trying to tell others about their story, because often it doesn't seem to fit together terribly well. Often it doesn't seem to make sense. And really part of treatment, part of recovery, is about helping people to put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle back together into a coherent kind of story to make sense of the experience.
Well, we're now seeing a situation where a number of veterans of the East Timor peacekeeping operation who've sought compensation from the Department of Veterans Affairs have been asked to provide very specific details of the traumatic events that they believe triggered their PTSD. How reasonable, then, is it to require them to provide that very specific detail?
It's a real problem, isn't it? I think that third-party insurers like DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, always have to draw a very delicate balance because, on the one hand, they do have a duty to the community, I think, to ensure that the limited resources that are available are going to those who are genuinely in need and that the system is not being abused and so on. On the other hand, of course, they need to ensure that the process is not unnecessarily adversarial, that it's not too distressing for the applicant, that it's not actually re-traumatising the person, which I think often is a bit of an accusation. It is a fine line. But I think if we're talking about PTSD, it's not unreasonable to ask the person what events triggered it because of the nature of the disorder. The disorder is such that it is tied to a specific event.
Mark Creamer.
I guess the thing to remember with this is we're dealing often with veterans who have got real issues. They're vulnerable. And if you go in too hard, there can often be ramifications which goes beyond the case.
When I spoke to the Minister for Veterans Affairs earlier this morning, he said to me, the community needs to know that we are testing the claims of veterans in cases where there is some doubt as to whether or not it's their military service which has been the trigger, if you like, for a condition such as PTSD or depression. We do need to test the evidence. What's your response to that?
Well, I accept that general premise, but I think there are a couple of points that I'd make. One is it's about balance of probabilities, and it's also about benefit of the doubt. And I think that when people have been through the sorts of things that many of these veterans have, we ought to be giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Shadow Minister for Veterans Affairs, Alan Griffin. You've been listening to Background Briefing. Our coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research and web mistress, Anna Whitfelt. Technical production by Lila Schooner. And our executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. And special thanks to Steve Kinnane for background and context for this story. I'm Tom Morton, and stay with us now on ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.